Then go on, give your useless intro.
I've slightly rewritten it.
Okay.
Oh, here we go.
Hello, and welcome to The Nod. Good start.
That is radio voice as well.
Hey, nice. Hey,
actually, we should get Foxy to do it for
us. We should, actually. Yeah. It'd be much better, wouldn't it? Maybe you can do it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Nod.
That's how you do it.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. I don't want a pickle. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. Hello, and welcome to The Nod.
The Nod is proudly supported by the British Motorcycle Insurance Community, the BMIC, a digital insurance-powered platform for riders and manufacturers that makes insurance work for the community. Visit thebmic.co.uk to learn how you and your community can benefit.
I tend to do little intros and I pull it off Wikipedia and we just test whether the facts are accurate or not. It's always quite good fun. Neil Andrew Howe Fox.
Correct.
Ooh. Born 12th of June 1961.
Correct.
Is an English...
Correct.
Yeah, correct. Radio DJ and television presenter, known for many years as Dr. Fox, before he became Foxy in the 2000s.
Wow. Well, I've kind of always... I've been Foxy since I was a kid, right? You know, because that's an obvious nickname if you're called Fox.
But then simply as Neil Fox, MD.
MD?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you got a doctorate?
No. And that's... Wikipedia's hysterical because I remember someone once, you know, really doing one of those interviews, and they go, so I've got to talk to you about your fascination with owls. And I went, I'm sorry. And then this is the crazy thing about Wikipedia. Anyone can change it.
You can add to it.
Right.
Yeah.
So someone had got in there like, I was an obsessed fan of Wickham Wanderers, and I've always been, for some reason, I've got this fascination with barn owls. And I went, no, I'm ever so sorry. Where'd you get that?
Yeah.
This dog is bonkers as well. She's, hello, darling. Little pointer. Hello.
Hi.
This is Holly.
Holly.
Hey, Holly. Nice to meet you. Hello.
You can leave that back door open because that's where his water is. Oh, okay.
Well, I think your missus was quite starstruck, I have to say.
Now that we know Foxy quite well now over the years, I think he must have had this amazing persona when being on the radio. Because the truth and the reality of
the legacy. There are two dull. Jesus, man.
No, but you must have got that. I mean, all over the years, it must be quite extraordinary, you know. I mean, being...
Do you know what the really funny thing is? Look, radio is... TV's an incredible medium because once you've been on someone's screen in their room, you know, in their living room, and they've like stared at you. TV, how people consume TV is very different from how you consume radio. So, you know, radio, you can normally be doing something else and the radio's on. You could be driving or getting up in the morning or doing your homework or whatever it may be, or at work. Whereas with TV, you're watching it, right? So, but if you've been on someone's TV, they know that face and they kind of go, God, I know you. I mean, even though they might not quite know what you do, they kind of go, you're so familiar. Whereas with radio, you're there every day of someone's life, particularly if you've like woken them. If you've been doing breakfast and you think, so when I did Capital for 17 years, 10 years on Magic, that's a long time to be in people's lives. Mm. And
And you're in people's private areas because a lot of the time you're in the car.
I'm in their shower. Yeah. I'm in their bedroom. I'm at their most vulnerable moments when they're waking up in the morning.
You define periods in people's lives, don't you?
And I don't. And of course, people, you forget how unique voices can be. Now, I don't think I've got a unique voice, but of course, people go, oh my God, I'd recognize your voice anywhere. And so if you've been in their life for years, literally, I think when people meet you, they treat you differently than you are on TV. So if people had only known me for like Pop Idol or a big glossy TV, that gives you a persona. Whereas on radio, incredibly, they feel they know you. Mm-hmm. And you're one of their friends.
Do you feel you give more of yourself on radio? You've got
My style was always like, I was very chatty about all kinds of stuff, really. It was a lot of it was, you know, sort of pop and prattle and fun and, you know, entertainment stuff. But, you know, of course, while you're going through life, whether it's talking about, oh, I had a great ride in on my motorbike today, it's little things you say that people build up a much bigger picture. And then obviously when I had kids or, you know, if I went up into a gig or a theatre show or whatever you've done, you talk about it on the radio. Mm-hmm. And then people go, oh, I remember the day, you know, you had Scarlett. I remember that. And you kind of go, really? And they go, oh yeah, because you were crying about it, you were so emotional about it. And you I suppose it's just if you get comfortable talking on the radio and they get comfortable listening to you, it is like a relationship. Yeah.
But I think it's different as well, isn't it? Because if you're a movie actor making movies, it's a TV shows is different. If you're if you're a newsreader or making documentaries, people see you slightly differently.
Of course.
As well.
Yeah.
You know, because they're not.
Also, I assume you're not untouchable. People would call in, you'd speak, so you have direct interaction with your audience, whereas making TV, you don't.
And we do lots of gigs, and you do lots of personal appearances.
You have people come on.
All kinds of interviews. I mean, God.
How many Christmas lights have you turned on?
Oh, my God. I mean, a lot, you know. And you think, how many gigs? We worked out how many people I'd probably played live to by doing gigs and presenting shows and doing this. And it's millions of people I've played to live, you know, from Big Party in the Parks we used to do, that like 100,000 people, all these kind of things. You kind of go, God, and how much money we've helped raise by doing, you know, charity stuff. All those things, you kind of forget how much you end up doing on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. But it's been fun. It's been a really interesting time. You know?
Do you know what? Party in the Park takes me back. I Bewitched were on Comic Relief, and I remember seeing them 97 in Southampton Common at Party in the Park. They barely changed, Bewitched.
What do you mean, their look?
Yeah.
I went to see ABBA last weekend, and they haven't changed at all. I mean, they've gotten younger.
It's a clever show, that, isn't it?
We all love ABBA or have a secret love for ABBA or you know.
I agree.
A friend of mine, Roy, he listened to ABBA all the time but never admitted it. You know, I go, really? I went to him and I got so confused watching it because it was a live band. You know, the band.
Yeah, they're good.
But the four, and I'm thinking, you know, and then they show the close-ups of them, which is clearly Avatar-y type.
Yeah,
it's holograms.
But then I'm thinking, well, are they holograms or are they just people dressed up?
At the end, when the four older members walk on stage, and you kind of go, oh, they filmed this bit too. They're sort of avatars as well, or that's a film bit. You kind of, I think it's really clever because you suddenly realise they're quite happy to be old people now. They're not trying to sort of pretend they're all young still. But I think it's a really clever show.
But it's such a wonderful use of technology. But a great thing now for those, you know, mega stars, mega bands to be able to have that technology to do that. Because if I think now, my musical childhood growing up, who would I have loved to see live would be, you know, Freddie Mercury, George Michael. I never got to see them live. Dire Straits, maybe.
Yeah.
And now people growing up with those musical idols can experience that in some
form. The David Bowie sort of estate are in serious talks now to try and work out, because I think that would really suit, because of the sort of flamboyance of him and all those different looks, what you can do and change all those looks. I think the Beatles, I think all of these people are in talks, because you go, oh my God, what can we do now?
Yeah.
You know, you think. Think what I could do with Yellow Submarine for the Beatles, or some of those Elvis or any of these people, and go, you could really do something.
I'm guessing you met a lot of the ABBAs and the Stones and the...
Yeah, you know, met all that. Yeah, met McCartney and Ringo Starr. Obviously, didn't meet the other two, sadly. Yeah, all the Stones and all the people from ABBA. The ABBA people were lovely, and they really are. Like, Benny and Bjorn are really nice people, who just really like music. And I mean, they're Sweden's second biggest export still.
Yeah, and they're still so
they are
clever and advanced. And they're just
smart,
in their music.
You know, smart people, but nice people. You know, I say they still wander down the street in sort of Sweden, and people go, hey, you're right. And so I don't think they sort of like limos and bodyguards and as some other sort of celebrities do. They just live their lives very openly, it seems, and that's probably why they are still normal, because a lot of that other stuff.
They had a terrible time for a while, didn't they? When they all split up, and
must have been really hard.
A messy time for
you think you're splitting up with your wives or your partners, and for the partners with their husbands
on stage, and
you're writing great songs about it, like The Winner Takes It All, and then well, let's sing. I've got a great song.
think about the money.
And it's a bit like Fleetwood Mac, you know, when you think they were all breaking up as well, you know, you think, and they were still
we had to come back.
Those guys still all on stage together singing these bitter songs, like that they've written out of sheer sadness and anger. And yet, oh, I've got a good song. Let's sing this one.
Did you become a radio DJ because you were... You wanted to play music?
I had no idea this is what I wanted to do when I was a kid. I thought I might end up joining the army. So I did all the sort of commissions board for Sandhurst and what have you when I was at school. Mm. And I was going to be a para engineer in the army for a bit of time. If I'd had my time again, I probably would have gone back in the army, but I would have gone in the army aircon, flown helicopters. I love flying. That's my other freedom. It's the same thing with biking, really. But I ended up at university doing a business degree at Bath. One of my work placements I spent in my third year was about 8 months in America. And I heard all this, this is sort of 1982, amazing American radio that sounded fun and crazy and well-marketed. And they had so much radio, unlike Britain, which was still pretty dull, really, back in. And I remember thinking, God, this is amazing. I'd always liked music. And I thought, if I could do radio like this, like back in Britain, maybe we should go back and do radio like this in England. This would be amazing. And that was sort of my light bulb moment. So I went back and sort of did the university radio station and thought, right, let's try and, you know, I could always talk. So let's try and learn how to be a good broadcaster and do fun shows and then try and get in radio. And that was the plan.
So that was the plan. So it was basically university that...
Yeah, it was. While I was at uni, that did it. And then I did manage to make some demo tapes, send them off to some radio stations, and managed by hook or by crook to sort of get into a little station in the Midlands after work. I'd got a job up there after uni, and I sort of ended up thinking I'll take the job in Worcester because it's got a little radio station there. And I'm never going to have a chance of getting on the big radio stations in London with no experience. So get somewhere little, get your foot in the door. Mm. So I had this regional plan. Yeah, regional ILR, independent local radio, as it was called. So Wyvern was this little station, and I did manage to get my foot in the door, help out, working for free, evenings, weekends, you know, whatever. And it was great fun. And then I got a job in there, and got a show, and then two shows, and then four.
And was it always music shows?
It's always been music radio. Yeah, I guess it's always been music radio. And I've always loved music. It's always been a part of my life, and you know, I still love it.
So you've somehow managed to become a DJ because of your love of music.
Yeah.
Ride motorbikes and go to concerts. And host concerts.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just doing your hobby, really.
Well, exactly. You know, it's been said many times, if you can find a job that you really love, then you'll never have to go do a day's work again. You'd meet, in a way, a lot of these musical heroes that you really loved. You could go and hang out with them in the end and sort of, you know, going, you know, I remember sitting around in George Michael's lounge because he trusted me in the end. So he said, oh, I can't be, you know, he's slightly reclusive in the end. Oh, come round to my house and we'll just do an interview around my house or sit by the pool, ever much easier, isn't it, than me having to get in the car or come down to you. Mm. And they just pop up to Highgate and we'll sit there and then he'd play me his new songs on his laptop. You know what I mean? It was kind of, so you go, you pinch yourself and go, this is cool. I really like this man. I love this man's music. And here we are having a nice cup of tea and, you know, playing with his dogs, listening to some new songs he's writing, and that you feel pretty privileged. Or when you've, you know, got Bon Jovi in your studio and they're playing live and you kind of go, well, this is good. There's me and my producer and an engineer.
Getting a free concert.
And we got a free gig. And this is awesome. You know, this is...
Bon Jovi always... There's something about them, isn't there? That's just so rock and roll.
They were just great. We had some great times with them.
So how have bikes been part of this journey? Did your parents have bikes? You know, what was your first memory of a motorcycle?
My dad had been into bikes. I've still got this lovely picture at home of my dad and my mum moving house from Wantage to Grimsby up north on a motorbike. And they literally had all their possessions on a motorbike. That was it. And they moved. And so he'd always been into bikes. And my uncle had run a big scooter garage and was really into bikes down in Devon. And his son still does it. You know, so whenever we'd gone down there, they were like, bikes and stuff, and he got an Ariel Square 4 in a box, and he was rebuilding, and there were scooters everywhere. So I guess, and then my elder brother, you know, he was into scooters and then bikes. My middle brother, a little bit into bikes. So we all had them when we were at school. And then I'd got one with a mate of mine when we were about 12 or 13. We bought a really crappy old Mobilette scooter, a little old French thing that had, and we ripped off all the sort of knee guards, and we stripped it down to basically a frame and a saddle and a pair of handlebars and an engine, and just hammered it round. His parents had a big garden, and we just like made this dirt track around his garden, just ripped his garden up for a couple of years and had a whale of a time, but falling off and jumping and, you know, just there was no danger really apart from falling off on grass or wiping out into a bush. It was great because it made me real. And I was just really into it and I couldn't wait to get a moped. And I got a moped and then I got, as soon as I could, I got like a DT125 and a DT175 and a DT250. Yeah, I mean, I was really into sort of those dirt bikes. Then I ended up getting a Honda when I got to university that was a sort of 250 dream. And it was sort of, it's just a really lovely bike, a bit more of a sort of a proper bike, you know, and just ended up being in bikes. And then when I got into radio, there was a couple of years where I didn't have a motorbike. And then when I managed to get my job back at Capital Radio, which was in September 87, you know, I really missed having a bike and realized I was in this wonderful situation now, whereas if I went and did a link all about motorbikes on the radio and how much I'm missing it, there was a pretty good chance that a manufacturer or someone's going to call me up and go, do you want to borrow one? Anyway, so everyone offered me bikes. You want to ride ours, Foxy? And so I did. And weirdly, at the last one I borrowed was a Harley. And I'd never in my life ridden a Harley Davidson. I remember turning up at my parents' house, showing my dad this bike. And he went, oh my God, a Harley Davidson. Oh, wow. And so he wanted to have a go on it. And it was a 1340, you know, low rider custom with that Evo engine. And there's something, although I loved all the other bikes, I loved the sort of burble and the feeling, the mechanical feeling of being on that Harley and the buh. So I was never really a speed freak. Mm. So I just liked the feeling of cruising around. So I ended up, that was 1988. And so it's 35 years now. I've been riding Harleys.
And how many bikes?
35 Harleys.
One a year, more or less.
Well, been that way. Yeah, I had had my first big fat boy.
Did you have
a couple of
have you had two or three at a time?
Yep. I have, and I've been playing, yeah.
How many bikes have you got at the moment?
One. I have one, which is this sort of a 2013 Road King, which I really love. And it's heavy, but it's, dare I say, practical, but it is.
Do you have a garage?
I have got a garage, yeah. And I like it because I like fiddling with bikes. Mm. So I like to play and fiddle. So I've got this bike, and I've done quite a few little bits and bobs. There are things I can do to bikes, and there are things I'll obviously send it off.
That's the lovely thing about Harley Davidsons, isn't it? Because you can, if you're a prolific changer of motorcycles,
yeah,
you don't have that much time to do much to your bikes, but you can. I mean, someone can buy a,
yeah,
whatever Harley it is, a Sportster or whatever, and then 2 years later completely change it.
Yeah,
it looks like a different bike.
There's your blank canvas, and you kind of go, yeah, I think now I'll change it. I'll have a cafe racer. Now I'll turn it into a flat tracker. Now I'll turn it into a chopper. You can. I guess that's the thing, which is pretty unique about Harleys, really. I think now it's interesting, you know, Triumph.
And a testament of time, because
it is.
Because they've been around and they've not changed massively for such a long time. So you have
until
so many
last
companies.
For 3 or 4 years. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So you have so many companies that have all this aftermarket stuff.
It's incredible.
Pages of it. Roland Sands' parents started off. They went into Harleys and they then started doing catalogues for God knows how many Harley parts.
And make some beautiful stuff.
They're called Zen or Zelms. I can't remember what they're called.
Well, I think Harley supply 10,000 aftermarket parts.
But you know, most of their money is T-shirts.
T-shirts, yeah.
And they're incredibly vicious about it as well. So if someone does a knockoffs, they are on them like...
Well, I guess you've built up a brand since 1903. It's going to be, 120 years this year. And I suppose if you... Every year they come out with, you know, the biggest brands in the world. They always come out with a list, don't you? And Coca-Cola's always on it. And I guess, you know, Apple, obviously. But, you know, Harley is always in the top five. What other brand would you think about having tattooed on you? If you think how many people have Harley, the brand of Harley Davidson tattooed on themselves. And it's a kind of a, I know there's a love, hate, a Marmite relationship with Harleys for a lot of bikers, because I think most people I would say that hate Harleys have probably never ridden one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in my experience.
And they're in countries that, you know, the idea of the sale of a Harley is on the open road in Death Valley.
Yeah.
Palm trees and heath. And
there's a preconception that if you ride a Harley, you should be wearing a patch and a leather...
Yeah.
Waistcoat, and you've probably got a massive gut, and
yeah,
there's stereotypes.
Ponytail.
Riding it. But there's a mystique.
I've had a sports bike and I've got a massive gut.
Yeah, but all of that mystique the history of Harley, all of the Hell's Angels stuff has created the brand that has that coolness to it. And when I first climbed on a Harley, I was saying, I was like, you know, my brother-in-law calls them Hardly Dangerous,
or,
you know, tractors and all the rest of it. But when you get on one, there is just something about the mark. There is something about the V that kind of does make you feel a bit cool.
Yeah.
You feel like you're riding a Harley, and if you've grown up around bikes, that's still quite a cool thing.
Yeah.
Whilst you may not, you know, you don't have to, you may not like the aesthetic, but the actual riding of them.
Yeah. And clearly there are bikes that go faster, handle better, go around corners better, stop better. Of course, there are all those things. But actually, there aren't many bikes. I'm sure there might be some Ducatis or some of the really sort of more specialist bikes that you really love, that you can slightly fall in love with. But, you know, if you go back and think of knuckleheads, shovelheads, you know, panheads, you know, Evos, there's something about just the names of these engines that have become iconic, right?
Yeah. Well, and they're a bit like music. They're absolutely of a period of time.
They are.
So when someone says, I've got a knuckle or a shovel or a thing, you know...
Yeah, you can.
..how those bikes have progressed.
And
you can't say that so much about... But other manufacturers, can you? You can't say that about, because they, so many other manufacturers build so many different types of bikes.
Yeah.
That
it would triumph with their Bonneville.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say with Triumph Bonneville, you could say the old BSAs and Nortons and stuff like that. They were iconic.
But then, through history.
But then, you know, they all, and the British bike building was enormous.
But there's different reasons. Things like Nortons, they were iconic because of their race pedigree, because they were raced and they won and they had moments in history. Whereas Harleys were just owned, weren't they? They don't have that race pedigree. They have that heritage of people.
They still have that flat track pedigree.
But the knuckles and the pans and all
and
those.
And it used to all be off-road. I mean, Harley Davidson was about, Harley and Indian both fought very heavily for off-road.
Well, if you think of World War One and World War Two, and how many of those bikes ended up going to war, and they were tough. And what's amazing is you look at those guys, you know, it's like, oh my God, it was, you know, foot clutch and what have you, and stick shift and geez. And they were going to war off-road, firing. It was amazing, really. But they were tough. They still are tough. I mean, I worry as a Harley fan now, I think, there's nothing in there, apart from the big baggers, which are still beautiful bikes. But to be fair, they're 25 grand plus, right? So they're really expensive, but they're beautifully built. I think they've got a problem that there's nothing in their showroom that I want anymore. There's nothing in there I go, that's cool. Their new Sportster, don't like it. It's not a Sportster. And they've got no entry-level bike. Their cheapest bike's 14 grand. You go, hang on. So that's why suddenly Royal Enfield are coming in and they've got 9% of the share, because you can buy a bike for 4.5 grand.
Yeah,
and it's nice, not bike. Crazy fast. Yeah. And get it insured. It's 400cc, right? Get your little Himalayan or your...
And they're cheap, so you're not... It's cheap. The insurance is cheap.
And you can mend
really
them.
They're really engaging bikes to ride. And
they are.
To the point
that... That mutt is the 400 mutt.
Yeah,
they've got a 400cc now, haven't they?
Have they? Yeah. I thought they had 125. They just bought.
Or is it 250?
They've got 125 and 250.
They might be bringing. They might have brought out 400.
Because that'd be a smart thing to do. Yeah. But again, look, your bikes for sort of under 4,000 quid that look really cute. If you drive around London, most of London now, sadly, is 20 miles an hour. Right, it's pathetic. But that said, you can't hare around on bike. You can't go crazy. You just want to get around town. And actually, going around on a little bike, just getting around, beating the traffic and beating the congestion charge and ULEZ and all that stuff, great. And if you can do it for 4 grand and insure it cheaply, I mean, wow.
I think there's going to be a new wave of if you go to Bali or Indonesia or places like that, you get the old, you know, the Honda.
The Cub, little step.
The Cub, the step through. Years ago, when I've been going to Bali for years, and there's a whole thing of customizing.
Yeah.
These bikes, and I saw one stunning one where they had, it was the Honda Cub. They kept all the plastic, but they'd lowered it, and it sat low. They'd done bits and pieces to it, kept it super simple, and this bike was stunning. And I reckon, you know, that's coming here.
Well, yeah. I went for a ride with a mate the other day, and we stopped off just down the road for a coffee, and he was like, I've got a new bike coming. It's just about to land in the country. I put a deposit on it months ago, like 6 months ago. I kind of forgot about it. And the guys just called me and said it's just come in, and it's a brand new, straight out the factory Honda Cub. Wow. They're making them again. You have to import them. They're not for sale here. So this guy's
Mr. Honda, that's
like 14
what he built.
Of them.
That's yeah. how Honda started, in his shed at the bottom of his garden. He built the Honda Cub. Yeah.
Which I think there must, how many
now
millions
Honda
of them?
City. So you work for Honda and your kids go to school in Honda City, and you can, because they do cars, they do electronics, they do bikes, they do, I mean, it's unbelievable, boats, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, it's great, this resurgence of, yeah, I think the low-capacity bikes, especially in places like
yeah,
London.
And chopping them up.
I was doing some research last night and I came across something. I realised it's your first anniversary of this 20-mile-hour speed.
Is it?
You had a bit of a run-in with a policeman.
Oh, wow. God, how'd you find that? That
was from the news.
Oh, no, it was in the news. That's right, actually, yeah.
News,
yeah, no, I did.
I've got some great sources.
No, I was going, yeah. No, no God, I do remember that. Weirdly, that was in Barnes.
Yeah.
And it
King,
was...
Queen's Ride.
Oh, my God, it was just outside my father-in-law's old house. And, I got stepped out. Speed gun, you can't really, you know, and I was doing 46 on a 20.
Yeah, that's just
and it was that moment where I just went, I literally was going turtle 20, 20, 20, and I guess a little roundabout by Queens Right where the road splits
over the bridge.
And I just went, yeah. Oh, and I just literally went the roundabout, just went, pfft. I'd been so bored of sitting in jams, and that moment I'm at 46, there he is, anyway. Oh,
so easy.
Yeah, they've done lots of people, but there's always a policeman that knocks around Barnes. He's always coming out of the bushes, hiding around for.
And we had good cop, bad cop in this one. So there's the guy that nicked me and the other one going, oh, Foxy, how you doing? And you think, okay, what? Thinking, oh, have we got a chance here of having a talking our way out of this? No. So it was...
well, apparently within the police world, traffic cops and cops,
they're quite different.
They're different breeds. Yeah. How many points did you get points?
Three.
Three.
Three and 800 quid.
Oof.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the report was way off. They said you got £232.06.
Yeah.
So, report.
Yeah, but listen, you're going to the Daily Mail. It's not.
Oh, no, actually,
it's not
it was 6 points.
It was six.
Yeah, and those the only, thank God, the only points I've got at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's so easily done.
It was.
Oh, I was knocking around for three years, I knocked around with nine.
Ooh.
The reason we started the Nod is because both Ben and I had testicular cancer. Both of us lost nuts. And helped us. I mean, we met each other because of testicles, but because of motorbikes as
the
well.
The lack of them. More
the lack of them, yeah.
We're attraction
we're often introduced, when we go on stage together, we're often introduced as one nut. But
and we just leave it up to the audience
we just leave it up to decide
who's
where
that
sits.
That's
it. But motorcycling and hanging out with your friends and motorcycling has always helped us and saved us sort of... Mm. Mentally, and I don't know how you feel.
No, I completely get that. I mean, years ago there was that, you know, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, wasn't there, that book? But I do think there's something very, there was a t-shirt Harley used to make many years ago, but although I love Harleys, I'm not one of these, everything else is shit, because I love so many other bikes as well. So, but, and this, you could have, and it used to say, Harley Davidson, if I have to explain, you wouldn't understand. And I think actually you could just go motorbikes. If I have to explain, you wouldn't understand. Because you kind of go, so today coming out here, it was wet and disgusting when I set off from London. And I just put my waterproofs on and my gear on. I rode out and I was thinking how nice it was riding along. It wasn't cold today. It was lovely, even raining, and how nice it was just to be out in the countryside riding along. And it clears your head. If you've had a busy old week and a crazy time, get on your bike and you can ride. For all those years when I was going from radio to voiceover to a TV show to an appearance, I'd use my bike to get around because I knew exactly how long it would take me, and I knew that going around town was the time when I wouldn't have to speak to anyone, or I wouldn't have to be Foxy, right? So I could just be on my own, just my own little world riding along, and time wise that would never make me stressed because I knew how long it would take me, but also it was just a nice way to be in my own space. And I do remember, I mean, God, if you want a specific time, and I've thought about this many times, 30th of September 2014 was a horrendous day in my life when I got arrested. and you think, so I'd ridden to work that day and it was the most beautiful day. And my route from work would normally be from where I live, just off the King's Road. I'd come down on the embankment and then I'd ride all the way along the embankment with the sun in my eyes, going to do a breakfast show along Battersea Power Station, right through Parliament Square. I had a really nice run, go to Trafalgar Square, and then I'd find my way up to where our studios were at Magic at the time, which were sort of quite close to Oxford Circus. And it was a really lovely run in that took me 12 minutes in the morning to get to work, sort of at the speed limit, because there was just zero traffic. And it was always a lovely way just to sort of wake up.
And get ready.
And get ready, yeah. Just wake up. And it was a lovely sunrise. But and then I had this crazy day where, you know, I'd end up being arrested and I'm in a cell. And it's like, I had no idea what was going on. I was completely... This has never happened to me, and I didn't know what to do. And for the first time in my life, I was really kind of like, what the fuck do I do? What's happening? And then after, you know, a day of craziness, I was like, right, okay, now I can finally go home and I can speak to my wife. And I sort of remember, oh, you know, there were lots of paparazzi all outside this, wherever it was, whichever police station I was at. And so... my lawyer got me out of there in the back of a police van in the sort of cage where they took me somewhere and they dropped me off. It was the most random thing. And then I thought it was close to Golden Square where the studios of Bauer were and Magic were and where my motorbike was parked. And I thought, so I need to get my bike and I need to go home. And so some people had brought down my kit to reception. I just grabbed my stuff from reception. I got on my bike and I put my lid on and I started to ride home. And I remember riding home through all the traffic madness of London going and then going along the embankment. And I just remember being on my bike thinking, just loving being on my bike. Just that moment of just going, okay, I'm slightly in control. I'm in my own little space here. And I knew that all around, and this sounds a really weird thing, but I knew all around me was this news story that was sadly going to hit all the headlines. It was already on the radio, but it was going to hit the headlines the next day in the papers. And I thought, this is my one little moment just to be me again on my bike when no one knows who I am. Mm-hmm. And it was a really lovely, free, anonymous 25-minute ride home through the traffic. And yeah, and... and then when I got home, there were like 30 paparazzi outside my house, you know, going crazy. And luckily I went through the back and they didn't see me. But knowing the next day I had to try and get my shit sorted out and go and, you know, find a lawyer and a QC and try and understand what was going on. And again, I remember going out, getting on my bike and putting my helmet on and being able to drive. Now you're in all the front of newspapers, but driving along, going in that sort of wonderful anonymous world, being in my own little space and kind of having to, you have to concentrate riding a bike, clearly, because there's cars all around you. But at the same time, it helps you cut off, I don't know if you find this, from some of the other stuff around you.
Around you.
So it was a really lovely way of, okay, not having to think about everything for a bit.
I could just
ride my bike. It was a beautiful distraction. And there are many times in that next 15 months until it was all sorted out when I'd have to be riding around town and just, it was my little bubble where I could be in my own little world on my bike, where I could just be myself and I didn't have to speak to anyone or no one knew who I was. And I think that's really special about bikes. And it really did give me some space, actually. And then, of course, riding with friends. Again, you've said that, you know, so there are times when during all this, you go, oh, let's go out for a ride. And you sort of meet your friends, you go out for a blast. And again, you're concentrating on riding and enjoying the riding. And it helps you blot out all the other stuff that's going on.
It makes you clearer, doesn't it? It's a bit like when you know, and the worst, I'm sure the worst of it is when you're in, when you have troubles, you know, the worst of it is when you know, you wake up in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and everything seems to be just
on top of you,
just on top of you, and you can't get your shit together. Those and then you're thinking as well completely unclear, because then when you then finally do go back to sleep and you wake up the next morning and half the shite that you go through that night isn't real.
Yeah, well, that's true. And most things, you know, most things that we worry about, will never happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing, right? So your mind, and when you're in a sort of a tough place, I think your mind can take you into some dark places, and it, you can think of the worst case scenario every time. And of course, yeah, inevitably, most of those bad things never happen.
But on those bad times, did you, because your life changed tremendously
it did.
After that.
It did.
And you had to almost reinvent what...
Yeah.
You were going to do and who you were going to be, and
yeah,
not who you're going to be, but
new starting again
to a
certain extent, yeah. Because I think it, whatever, if people make allegations against you for whatever reason, you can go through a massive process to clear your name, but of course, even once it's cleared, it's not really the end of it. Because particularly if you're in a public facing job, because the people that employ you are so risk averse now to everything, they're so worried, these big companies and corporations, that they just go, maybe it's just easier never to employ you again. We'll just employ someone else. Yeah, you might be good at what you do, but we'll just forget it.
Yeah.
And so there was a time when, and actually, weirdly, my bike was, again, I started working with an old friend building an app, a music app. It was a game that I'd known him for a long time, this guy, and we were creating this game called Beat the Intro, which is sort of like Name That Tune. And we were creating a gamified version of it for an app. And he had got some investment, and we'd got this little railway arch in Windsor. And so I think 4 days a week, I would ride out to Windsor, which is only like 24 miles. But God, it was great. Mm. Like rain or shine, warm or cold. There was something, I loved it. I'd get on my bike, I'd ride out there, clear my head, and going out there and then riding back, it was 48 miles of joy every day. I really enjoyed it, you know, just being able to be on my bike every day. It was really, and it actually made me start thinking, God, maybe I should live out of town, because there's some lovely places out of town, and riding every day. I mean, for me, it'd be great, but I think for my wife and my kids, definitely were like, we're not moving out of town. Because their lives were in town at that moment, you know. That's, who knows, it might change. I've got one child, my youngest is 16 now, so she's in first year of A-levels. So, you know, who knows when she's finished, what might happen. I don't know.
Well, there is life after children, which is...
Well, yeah, there is.
And I mean, I have to say, when our second child went to university and people talk about empty nest syndrome, I mean, you know, they left and like next day was like, oh my God, it's just like it was before you had children. You know, you come back from work and you'd have 2 or 3 hours of not having to do anything before you went out, or you know, it was totally different.
And the house was tidy. It was probably how you left it. You know, you kind of go, well, look, things are still where they were.
But it's like weekends.
And so, what do you do? What's up with Foxy these days? I know you and I have spoken through some TV ideas that.
We have. It's interesting.
I enjoy those chats.
I tell you what, I haven't really gone to seek much mental help during all of this, although I did go and talk to a woman who, someone said, she could be, a lady called Anna, could be quite interesting to talk to, who was kind of like a life coach, business coach, spiritual guide. She was just interesting lady. And so she had no real idea who I was, which was good. So I just turned up. I'm Neil. Hello. So tell me. And so I explained, I talked through my life. She said, well, tell me about your life. And so I talked about my life and what I had done, how I'd grown up and what I'd done and what I'd been through and the rest of it. And then after a time, she said something that no one's ever said to me before. And she just went, yeah. She said, you know what, Neil, I just think you've been in the wrong profession all your life. It's like,
what?
And you kind of, what? And you kind of go, well, hang on, I've been really good. I've enjoyed it. I've done very well at it and what have you. And she went, yeah, I don't know. I think you're more the business side of what goes on than necessarily being, you know, in front of the camera or in front of the microphone.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, more of the, because at the time I've been talking about, there's this business I want to create and what have you, and maybe sort of produce some TV shows. And there was this other idea for another app-based business that I wanted to build. And she went, that's what you should do. That's what you need to be doing. Because she also said, there's no doubt that if you were, you know, if you'd been very good at what you'd done, which was I had been, and sort of been there, seen there, won everything, got the T-shirt, then when in a way, you're speaking after all my troubles. You speak to some of those, in maybe the bosses who were had been on the trying to contact your agent, trying to poach you, get you to go over there, and now they wouldn't give you the time of day. You kind of go, well, that's pretty demoralizing, isn't it? It's pretty irritating. And she went, okay, there's a really good way of never being, in a way, rejected again. And I go, what's that? And she went, never ask him for a job.
Yeah.
And I went, okay. And she went, yeah, no, no. So if all these, if you find it slightly frustrating that these people are now not giving you the time of day when they did before, just imagine if you never phoned them up or never got in contact, they could never say no. And then you wouldn't be pissed off. And I went, yeah, okay, that sounds quite logical. And she went, it's really logical and it's really simple. So just do the other thing that you wanted to do and then you'll never have this problem again. And it was kind of very black and white.
Be your own person. I suppose always as a DJ, I suppose you were always employed by somebody, weren't you?
Yeah, I was always a freelance employed by these employed businesses.
So you were reliant on...
Yeah, and that's how I, you know, of course, and you go, okay, and so what's really difficult, if you've gone through, and hopefully it'll never happen to anyone, but if you're going through life earning a really good salary, and then of course you always gear your life up to that salary, right? And you suddenly got your three kids at school and everything's going on and everything, and then suddenly literally one day it's the tap just goes off. It's like off, you know, it really is. Okay. And then you realize how much you spend a month. You go, are you serious? How can we spend that much a month? Right. And then you kind of have to, there are many good sides of it though. I have to say, obviously all the time I was going through my adversity, if I call it that, or my troubles, a year before me, one of my best friends who had been my best man, who was a guy called Nico, my friend Nico sadly died in an awful boat crash in Cornwall that sadly was also front page news because his whole family were involved in this tragedy.
That was your
friend. And so he died. His 8-year-old daughter died with him. His wife lost half a leg. And then there were three other kids. One of them who got his foot severed really badly. It was a real mess. And so it is a really good thing. You have to sometimes go, there are always people who are having a way worse time than you are.
Yeah. And that puts it into perspective as well.
You need to give it some perspective. Yeah, you do. So,
sure. So
my friend Victoria, who, look, you know, I was godfather to one of their kids, and she's, look, we're all godparents to each other's kids. You looked at this woman now who'd lost a leg and was in a wheelchair, and she was going, okay. Now, when I woke up and thought I'm having a slightly shit day, and I go, yeah, she lost a leg, daughter, husband. Okay. She's always going to be having a worse day than me. And I think it's really useful. I mean, she's become the most incredible inspirational woman, talking, getting through adversity, running marathons. She's insane, right? She's brilliant. And and she got through all that, and a lot of help and counselling and some great people that have helped her rebuild her life. And I think one of the things that always stuck in my head was, okay, you can't whinge. Okay, although you've had a bit of a tough time, she's had a way worse time.
Yeah.
And I know you can't always do that.
No, but it's very true. I mean, listen, I remember waking up in 2016 with two completely smashed, destroyed legs and a smashed up hand, right hand. And I woke up and I looked down at my body and I had three limbs not working. And I was feeling very sorry for myself. And I then realised there was someone else in the room. And I looked over and the person in the other bed was in much, much worse state than me. And I remember, I never forget, I looked over at the person, I looked down at my stuff and I started to chuckle. And I was thinking, actually, this isn't so bad.
Yeah.
And I was actually quite pleased with myself. I was thinking, actually, I think I got away with that, you know. And so and luckily that happened almost immediately after the accident. And,
okay.
And I thought, okay, right, this is just an inconvenience now.
I remember seeing that. I was sat in a chemo ward, hooked up. You know, I was 30, just lost my second testicle. Cancer had spread to my lymph nodes. And I was in UCH, like the 12th floor, for 3 days, just hooked up to chemo, and I felt awful, and I was in a really dark place mentally. And there was this 18-year-old kid the other side of me who was yellow because of the chemo he was on,
And the doctors were talking to him about the fact they were going to chop his legs off. And I was like, I'm going to be all right.
Like, yeah.
I'm 30. I've got a kid, you know, and I'm going to get through this. I'm not 18 with my whole life ahead of me about to lose a leg and worse. I was I'm all right.
But it is important to, as you said, coming through troubles, and we've all come through troubles, and to realize, and some I've met people, and I've often spoken to lots of people who've had big injuries and stuff, and some people get stuck where the accident is, and they get stuck in that trauma and can't move forward and stay stuck there for a long time.
I was depressed for a year, yeah, but couldn't see it, couldn't understand, yeah, it, didn't
and,
acknowledge
and because
it.
You can't get past that trauma, and by someone, you know, by that lady who spoke to you, changed, yeah, your thought, changed your mind.
She did, actually.
Yeah. Something triggers, and
because I remember thinking, there are a few things I remember whether people had said it to me. I mean, luckily, I've got a wife who's a yoga teacher, and so she had read an awful lot of, and reads a lot of really sort of interesting,
yeah,
spiritual books, and, you know, those. Lots of those books, those sort of motivational quotes and comments in there. And a lot of them really did ring true. And there was this one that she had, which was called the Serenity Prayer, that's, I think, become...
Oh, is that the AA thing? Is it the Serenity Prayer?
Yeah, exactly. They use it. That basically goes, help me understand the things I cannot change. Help me change the things I can. And help me have the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah,
because you kind of go, there are certain things in your life that maybe you can't change or affect, then don't worry about them. Okay, what's the point of, so if you've got X amount of hours in a day or X amount of energy, like, look at the things you can change and have the courage to change them. Okay, but then if you can understand that, if you have the wisdom to know the difference, what I can change and can't change, you'll save yourself maybe a lot of wasted time. And I remember trying to go through this, and someone said, actually, if you look at this, there was a time I'd been doing a lot of radio and I was getting a bit bored of it. Radio was becoming very corporate. It was creating these very big brands. So the idea of smaller local radio was dying in a way. And then you got the BBC and you got these three giant companies. And there were lots of changes happening in radio. None of it was about making radio sound better or more interesting or more entertaining. It was all about consolidating and basically making more money
and
making
costs,
them better, cutting
basically.
Costs and making a better business.
Yeah.
And it was getting a little bit dull. I'd been in a way a really an amazing time of, yeah, broadcasting coming
golden
from the sort
era.
Of 80s, 90s. The Capital was insane. It was the most brilliant team, brilliant bosses. It was incredible. And then you could see it all changing when we got past the millennium. And I remember thinking, oh God, maybe I've got to stop this at a certain time and try and not get up every day, because you're on an amazing hamster wheel, a really well paid hamster wheel, but I'm still on a hamster wheel. Got to get up, go to work, got to do this thing every day, like most people do. I know the sort of the daily grind. Mine was just
but early in the morning, every morning, five up at 4:30 in,
yeah,
the morning.
Look, luckily I'm quite a happy guy in the morning, so once the alarm's gone off and it's like, oh, getting on my bike was always a great way of waking, yeah, up. Whereas that was really good. So I was always awake by the time I'd arrived, rain or shine. But I do remember thinking, God, potentially, okay, I've had this thing that has forced me to stop being on the radio at the moment. Maybe this is the moment where you go, okay, this could be the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. This could change my life. And if I could either sit there and go, oh, woe is me, this is awful. Or you go, okay, got to use this opportunity to go, I've had to reset and I've got to learn some new skills. Maybe this is the moment where you go, okay. And I also, there were two other things I remember thinking, I don't want this to be the sort of biggest chapter of my life. I don't want it to be. I want this to be a chapter, because it was, of my life, but with other things that are going to come, lots have happened before. This is a chapter, and there'll be some really interesting stuff afterwards as well. Because I sort of ended up with this mantra in my head going, if ever I wrote a book, it will be called Better, Not Bitter.
Ooh.
Because I thought it would be, that's what I wanted to come out of it. Just going to go, okay, I need to be, can I learn anything from what's happened to me? Can I learn anything? Can I be a better person? Actually, can I have a better life? can I, whatever a better life means, doesn't necessarily mean what.
That's what people ask me, do I have regrets? And I don't really, because everything that's happened to me is maybe the person I am today.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And you can't change anything that's happened.
It's always interesting.
You can't do it. And there's no point in thinking, I wish, if only.
Yeah.
How, why, no. You know, it's just a waste of time.
Like the things I've been able to do since having had cancer twice, the opportunities that presented themselves, partly due to the cancer, you know, because I went to work for Movember and did loads of amazing things with them for years and met Charlie off the back of it, and we've become friends, and the things we get to do together, you know, I wouldn't have had those opportunities had I not lost my bollocks.
Yeah.
Would I like to still have bollocks? Yeah. Well, up to a point. I mean, they come to a point in your life where they're pretty, you know, they just get in the way and kids jump on them and you don't use them anymore and they're redundant. But and I can live a full, healthy life without them. So actually, you don't. I've kind of
used, what's that? How, you know,
I've
how,
used them up and they've served their purpose and they've gone now and they're not in the way anymore. As much comfier on bikes, cycling, motorbikes, all of that stuff. Entering cold bodies of water is a breeze nowadays.
Wow. So don't recreate bollocks and put them in there.
No, Charlie's got a fake one. So he's
got a fake nut.
Yeah, he's got a full.
Yeah, I've got a silicone one, but it's I wish I'd never done it. But,
oh, really?
They say, do you want one? You go, well, I don't know.
They never even asked me.
You know, because when you do extreme sports and stuff, your nuts pull up and get out the way, whereas this false testicle just didn't. So I would kept sitting on it and pulling it. And
you know, you do see, I think if you go through any form of adversity, I'm sure you found as well, and both of you, that you find out who your friends are. Are the ones who are really there and just checking up on you and seeing if you're okay. And, you know, I certainly did. And, like, you know, quite a few of my really good mates, they ride as well. So it's interesting, you know, just there was always riding would always be part of our conversation. You know, where should we go? Let's jump on our bikes and ride a bike shed for a cup of tea. Hardly the greatest ride across London from Fulham to Shoreditch. But, you know, it doesn't matter. It's fun. Or just drive down. Let's go down to Rikers and have a cup of coffee down there or something and just ride home. It's just nice to sort of somehow just also to have these things to look forward to.
And do it together.
And do it together,
well.
Yeah.
Even though you're on your own. I mean, people used to say to us, with you and I, when we rode motorbikes together for 4.5 months, and some people go, Christ, what have you got to talk about after 4.5 months? But actually, when you're riding along the road and you stop at the end of the day, or if you go to Rikers or whatever, and someone says, oh, did you see that person do that, or did you see that waterfall, or did you see that whatever it was, and you go, no, I didn't see the waterfall, but did you see that bend in the river? And they go, oh, I didn't see that. And so sometimes when you're sitting, have a cup of tea when you finish the ride and you're camping, you know, you talk about a day's riding as if you've both ridden a different road.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then if you've got nothing to talk about, then you just talk about motorbikes.
Well, it's a bit like our ride today. You know, it was probably very different for Neil riding his Road King on those horrid roads than it was for me on my Desert X. You know, I was riding in the middle, in the muck, having a lot of fun.
Desert X.
Have you mentioned that before?
God,
Charlie, as I said, I only own one.
The only reason you bought one is because I did that video about it on my YouTube channel. But, well, Foxy, thank you for coming along. And, oh, you're supposed to do that bit, aren't you?
No, you can do that.
I like the idea of the nod, though. I like the nod. I think it's a nice name for this, because that sort of, the nod, you give is so true.
It is. Yeah, right. It is. It was. I think it was my idea. The nod, wasn't it?
Most things are.
Yeah. But nobody
when
was
it comes
real,
to the telling of the story.
Yeah, telling the story. Well, it's never get the truth get in the way of a good story, as my father would always say. No, but it's been a real pleasure.
No, it's been very enjoyable. Thanks for taking me out for a little pootle round the Surrey Hills. I enjoyed it.
Slushy, muddy Surrey Hills.
It's funny. I've never before. Here's a confession for you. I've never before been envious of someone else's bike, but when I was riding today on some of those little roads when it was a giant bit of mud in the middle of it and you're down the sort of edge there and in some potholes and there's a car when you know you're on a big heavy Road King and of course old Flash Bastard was behind us in his Desert X. Look at this.
You know, he's a bit like one of those one of those guys who wear skinny jeans and check shirt and
a bit of a hipster.
Yeah,
he's got his accessory now.
Oh, look, there's Woody. Oh, it's a good time to stop now.
That's a good time to stop, yeah.
Muchas gracias, amigos.
Pleasure.
Pleasure to have you on.
Do you have to plug your insurance people again?
Yeah, I do, actually, yeah. Cool. Yeah. Although, because it's going to get... Oh.
Thank you for listening to The Nod, a mindful motorcycle podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. Do make sure you subscribe to get your alerts and share the show to help us grow. You can also follow us on Instagram at The Nod Pod. And a big thanks to our friends and sponsors at the BMIC. Do check them out online and join the community. We will be back next week with another guest who we'll be hitting the road with and having a chat. Join us next time, and until then, stay safe, be kind, and check in with a mate.